Dear Venerable and friends, can you hear me, those who are sitting at the back? Okay. When I came here, Venerable Dhammaratana Nayaka Thera gave me a few topics to select one to give a talk on. And I selected this topic. It's a challenging topic, Heart of Buddhist Wisdom. So I like to divide this time into two sections. First, I speak for sometimes, and then answer your questions if you have any, and we plan to finish all by 11:40 according to his request. Since you all are interested in Buddhism and some of you are Buddhist, this topic is very important. Why somebody wants to talk about Buddhist wisdom? We talk about compassion and wisdom in Buddhism. And Buddha himself is known to be an embodiment of compassion and wisdom. Does that mean that others did not have wisdom? Probably they did. They have their own wisdom. But Buddhist wisdom is very special. I like to spend a few minutes outlining how the Buddha became wise, wiser than most other people, from his own lifestyle, from the things that he taught. We can see how wise the Buddha and his teaching are. From his childhood, he manifested his wisdom. He was not an ordinary person. He was a genius. Any tiny little thing is enough for a genius to evoke to the reality, to open to the reality. So he was, from his childhood, a contemplative person. Every tiny little thing, he learned from anything. And he saw the true nature of life, which was not very pleasing to him. So he always spent his time trying to figure out how to find a solution to life's problems without much help from his parents, teachers, associates, friends, and so forth. His wisdom was so deep that when he visited his teachers, as you all know, he outshone the teacher's wisdom. Last two teachers are Alarakarama and Uddaka Ramaputta, as you all know. And he learned their teaching very quickly. as soon as he heard the words, and as soon as the word escaped their lips, he understood the meaning. That shows how sharp, how intelligent, how wise he was. Then he realized what he learned from them was not sufficient for him to gain what he was looking for. And he returned to them and asked, is that all you have to teach me? They said, yes. But at the same time, Prince Siddhartha Bodhisattva saw that these two teachers have intelligence, wisdom. They had saddha, sati, virya, samadhi, panya. Faith, mindfulness, effort, concentration, and wisdom. They had wisdom. But still they are stuck in samsara. And he learned from them a system of meditation. And even after practicing their method of meditation, he still remained in the same boat along with them. And when he saw them having these five, what we call spiritual faculties, he began to question these spiritual faculties are the faculties which later on he developed to attain full enlightenment. But the teachers have the potential, they have these five spiritual faculties, but they have not utilized the spiritual faculties because their wisdom was not that sharp and deep. So, their saddha, faith, was limited to what they knew. Their effort was limited to what they have achieved. Their mindfulness was limited to what they have learned. Their concentration was limited to gain the highest degree of one-pointedness of mind. Their wisdom was limited to end their hindrances. Now the hindrances like greed, hatred, sleepiness, drowsiness, restlessness and worry and doubt are suppressed by attaining the highest level of concentration. And therefore they were wise enough to overcome these hindrances and attain the highest level of concentration. But that is not the end of the whole practice. And although he himself followed their instructions, he could not find a solution to what he was looking for. In his deepest wisdom, he realized that they would be, even after their passing away, they would stay in samsara. So he was looking for a way to get out of samsara. But their teachers had not found it, in spite of all these achievements, through concentration. These individuals would pass away and take rebirth in Brahma realms, where the lifespan is for many eons. Once that limit, that lifespan was over, they would be reborn in other heavens or even human lives and still repeat the same thing all over again. So they caught up in this vicious cycle of birth and death. So they could not, because they were not so, their wisdom was not so deep and sharp, and they kept on following that. Then, he began to realize, what is the wrong? What is the problem? How can they stay in this vicious cycle, having attained this level? Then he took, then he began to follow his own way and went to Buddha Gaya and sat down in under the Bodhi trees with cross-legged position. And then he began to think, what kind of subject should I use? I have used the subject that they recommended me, that is following my breath. They followed their breath and attained stages of concentration, and I followed it and I gained concentration, but I have not attained what I wanted. Now what should I do? What kind of subject should I follow? Then he remembered what he did when he was a little child on the ploughing festival day, sat under a rose apple tree and sat down and meditated. And that time what did he use? He used only his breath. So what is the difference? Now that time he used the breath, and this time he used the breath. That time he just attained the first level of concentration. This time he attained the last level of concentration by using the breath. And still he is in samsara. So now he began to wonder, what subject should I use now? Although I have been using breath as an object of meditation, I have not attained what I wanted. Nor have my teachers attained the final stage. And what kind of subject I should use beside the breath? Then this is how wisdom works. Because of his penetrative insight, because of his wisdom, he thought, nothing wrong with the subject. But none of my teachers knew the hidden secret in this subject. Something is very deeply embedded in the subject of breathing. What is that? He realized in the breath there is all the necessary and sufficient conditions for attaining liberation. And that secret is seeing, penetrating the breath, using the breath and penetrate, using the breath, he wanted to penetrate the breath. And he found within the breath there is a very important factor which affects all living existing things. That is impermanence. He saw the breath is impermanent. Whatever is produced through the breath also impermanent. We all are alive because of breath, and our lives are not permanent. Just like the breath is impermanent, life is impermanent. Every living, breathing being is impermanent. No matter how lofty the life is, it is impermanent. So when he was struggling, looking for a state beyond this cycle, he saw being oneself subject to birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. If one were to unite with somebody else who also is subject to birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, then you multiply your problems twice. You yourself being subject to this, you join with someone else who also is subject to these things, then instead of reducing your birth, growth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain and grief and despair, you multiply it, you add another being into that. So, he wanted to get out of that. He wanted to get out of this vicious cycle. And then he saw all these beings are made to be alive through the process of breathing. And within that process, he found something called impermanence. And his teachers did not see that. Teachers used the breath to gain concentration, but they did not see this hidden secret of impermanence, of concentration. And then he saw whatever is impermanent is not satisfactory, because no matter how long it lasts, it is not giving us permanent satisfaction. Buddha would not appear in the world when people cannot understand impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. So he came to this world through many eons of practice to learn this, teach this, and then attain liberation. So he saw this. He saw in this very subtle, very precious, very important phenomenon called breathing, there is impermanence. And he penetrated that. And he saw impermanence, every impermanent thing is unsatisfactory, not purely because they are impermanent, they are unsatisfactory, but because of the attachment to the impermanent things, we experience unsatisfactoriness. Something can be impermanent and yet we will not become unsatisfactory with that impermanent thing, because whatever certain things impermanent are unhappy things, unpleasant things. When they are impermanent, we experience pleasantness. For example, when you have pain, pain is impermanent, and when pain disappears, you experience pleasure. Therefore, the change of pain, disappearance of pain, does not cause you pain, which rather causes you pleasure. Something you appreciate and you are attached to it, when it, whatever you are attached to it, when that particular thing fades away or disappears, you will be unsatisfactory, unhappy. For example, suppose you have a cup. The cup is brittle, subject to change, and sometimes one day it will fall and break into pieces. Then you don't worry about it, because you can get another cup. So the breaking away, the breaking the cup would not make you unhappy. You know it is impermanent, it disappeared, so you get another cup. But if that cup happens to be something that reminds you a very important occasion in your life, somebody whom you love very much has given this as a gift, or on certain occasions like wedding, birthday, somebody has given it to you to remember that particular occasion, you love it, you become attached to it, it has sentimental value, you keep it in certain place with great love. And if it breaks, then you will be unhappy. Why? Not because the cup was brittle, subject to change, but because your attachment to the cup, you become unsatisfactory. So everything impermanent is unsatisfactory so long as we are attached to it. If we are not attached to it, no matter how things are impermanent, then they don't make us unhappy. So Siddhartha Gautama saw this reality. It is, things are all, everything is impermanent, and everything impermanent makes us unhappy so long as we are attached to it. We cling to it. And then he saw the reality of not having something to stop this. When we are attached to something, and when it disappears, we become unhappy, and nobody on earth can make us happy. There's no power within us. So he saw this. Seeing these three things so clearly, he realized this is the way, this is the method, this is what I want to realize. So he abandoned his teachers and went to Buddha Gaya, sat down and start focusing his mind on this reality, experiencing this reality, focusing mind on his on this reality. He gained deep concentration. When you gain concentration, you utilize concentration, you don't stop there. When you gain concentration, only then can you see things exactly as they are. As Buddha has mentioned in many times, samahitam cittam yathabhutam pajanati, concentrated mind sees things as they really are. So when he went to Buddha Gaya, sat down and started practicing concentration meditation, and gained what we call jhanas, number 1, 2, 3, 4. When we gain the fourth jhanic state, which has 8 very special qualities, like the purity, parisuddha, pariyodata, white, anangana, without stain, vigatupakilesa, without idiosyncrasies, mudubhuta, soft, kammaniya, pliable, titha, steady, ananjapata, imperturbable. These are the qualities of the deeply concentrated state of mind. It's a very powerful state of mind. With this state of mind, his teachers had this state of mind, but they did not know how to use it. Siddhartha Gautama's wisdom was so deep, so sharp, so powerful, that he learned how to use this very clear, sharp, pure, steady, imperturbable state of mind to look at his own life. And he saw this cannot be the one and only life. He saw the pattern this life has followed. He saw this life has certain traits which he has not acquired only in this life. He saw that this life has brought something from another life. So he began to contemplate, and he saw many, many, many eons of his previous lives. That's called Pubbe Nivasana Suti Jnana. And this he discovered through his own wisdom. And he went back as far as he could to the almost infinity, and found there is no beginning. Many people try to find the beginning of life, beginning of universe, beginning of world. Then through his deep insight he realized there is no beginning. No beginning. This is one question many people ask these days. How can something exist without a beginning? How things started? How the world started, how the universe started, when started, and so forth. For some people, very answer is very simple. And they say it was created, and so forth. Then that leads to further tricky, hair-splitting questions, which they cannot answer. Buddha did not want to get involved in that. He realized, he saw with his deep wisdom, there is no particular beginning. And then he looked at the life of other individuals. And they too die and take rebirth according to their karma, just like he did. And he could not find the beginning of their lives. And then, this is the most important point in his wisdom. Then he tried to connect these two. Now, I could not find the beginning of my life, and I cannot find the beginning of their lives, but this keeps, these lives of ours, keep going on and on and on forever. What is the reason why this happens? At that point, he saw the reason are two-pronged. One is ignorance, the other is craving. Ignorance and craving. Because of ignorance, we, the living individuals, commit all kind of wholesome, unwholesome, physical, mental, verbal activities. Wholesome, unwholesome, physical, verbal, intentional activities are committed through ignorance. And ignorance itself does not have a beginning. You cannot say ignorance started at such and such a point. Before that you did not have ignorance. If you did not have ignorance at one point, there is no reason for you to have ignorance after that. That means ignorance also is beginningless. A beginningless ignorance makes this beginningless life. So people, it's very much like egg and chicken argument. And then ignorance cannot exist without greed. Nor can greed exist without ignorance. So, and these also are intertwined. This is what we call catch-22, and there is no escape. So he found this. He discovered this. And then he, from his own experience, he saw there must be a way out of ignorance, a way to get rid of ignorance and to get rid of craving. And that he found what in the process that he followed to achieve this state, and that method is called the middle path. Following that, he followed it step by step, very reasonably, mindfully, using his concentration, he followed the steps. And then he saw ignorance and craving are what you call fetters that bind together, bind individuals to samsara, to repeating birth and death. And this is a very profound teaching. This is called dependent origination teaching, or paticca samuppada. When he realized this, he was able to overcome his greed and ignorance and destroy his fetters and defilements. This is called the knowledge of destruction of defilements. And that instant he attained full enlightenment. So the binding factor of ourselves to samsara are these two factors, ignorance and craving. And nobody prior to him or even after him gained this wisdom. That's why Buddha himself, after the attainment of enlightenment, even in his first sermon, he mentioned that among human, divine, Brahmas, nobody before him had attained this stage. And also, this stage he realized through three levels. A level of theory, and level of practice, and level of realization. At one level, he knew it as a theory. And he did not stop it as a theory, he put the theory into practice. When he put the theory into practice, he came to realization. Only then, without any hesitation, he declared to the world from his own experience that he attained full liberation, enlightenment. So, seeing the dependent origination as it is the heart of Buddhist wisdom. Everything exists not independently but dependently. And this dependent origination is a core or heart of Buddhist wisdom. Awareness or understanding of the interconnectedness of existing things. Nothing can exist by itself on its own. The method he employed to achieve this is called the Noble Eightfold Path. That is why sometimes we call his teaching is the Middle Path or the Noble Eightfold Path. So, this is not very easy to realize. One who realizes this, one who understands this, attained this stage, is called awakened one, or an enlightened one, or the Arahant, who knows when he attains that level. You know, this is very difficult for many people to understand. One who attains this level can say very confidently, with trust, without any hesitation, one can say, I have laid down the burden. I have done what was to be done. There is nothing more to do. And nothing more, no more existence in samsara. This is the last existence, last birth. Friends, this is a very clear, very unmistakable conclusion of a one who has wisdom to realize this state. And this is the Buddhist heart of Buddhist wisdom. People can say, I have attained enlightenment, I have gained knowledge, I have gained wisdom, but they do not know what is ahead of them. What have they done? What they still have to do? They don't know. They just make this expression, this statement, without knowing what they have done, what they have to do. So somebody who has this kind of deep wisdom can say without any hesitation that I have done what was to be done. And that is the person is very intriguing whenever we begin to think about it. The person who seeing all kind of problems in the world, countless trillions of problems in the world, that person can remain very calm, steady, peaceful, equanimous, without being affected by worldly vicissitude. Why? Because the person has gone through all the problems in the world. Every problem the person has encountered, seeing, and therefore seeing, you know, Buddha is the one who can see the world's problems. It is said that whenever he wanted to know any person's mind, at any stage, he was able to see the mind at any stage. You know, if you have that ability without realizing, having this wisdom, you will go crazy. Because people have so many problems. 6 billion people among human beings, and countless animals, countless divine beings, all of them have one problem, not all of them have millions of problems, each of them. And Buddha was able to see them whenever he wanted. But he never went crazy. Why? He was very, very deep, he had deepest wisdom. So, this is why in Mangala Sutra you read the last stanza, it said, Puttasya lokadhammehi chittam yasa na kampati asokam virajankhemam etam mangalamuttamam. Being encountered worldly vicissitudes, if one's mind does not shake and does not fill, mind does not fill with sorrow and lamentation, and remains without the stain, that is the highest blessing. Only when you have the deepest wisdom, you will have the highest blessing. And I give you another very simple example. Example is simple, but the message is very profound. Just to understand what Buddhist wisdom is. Buddha said, seeing the body like a clay pot, and seeing the mind like a city, one should fight Mara of defilements and gain or win the fight. Once you win the fight and gain, protect it without attachment. It sounds very tricky. Looking at the body like a clay pot. The body is subject to breath, like clay pot. Kumbhupamang kaimamang viditva, nagarupamang chittamidang tapetva. See the mind like a city. Just imagine a city, like Singapore City, or New York City, or Colombo, Calcutta. You will go crazy. So many things are happening in a city. So many things. And those things are happening in our mind. And then, you cannot count the number of things are happening in a city. Similarly, so many things are happening in our mind. And yet, using your weapon of wisdom, fight the Mara in the mind. Mara is all kind of defilements, all kind of problems, all kind of atrocities, all kind of tension, worries, fears, anxiety and so forth. So many things are happening. But using the weapon of wisdom, you gain when you use the weapon of wisdom, you gain. Once you gain, protect what you have gained without attachment. How can you do that? The very fact that you try to protect something is an indication that you are attached to it. If you are not attached to it, you are attached to something, you will never try to protect it. Buddha said, labhang paticca, tannang paticca pariyasana, pariyasanang paticca labho, labhang paticca parigaho, parigaham paticca ajyasanang, ajyasanang paticca vinicceyo, vinicceyam paticca arakka, arakkam paticca, so forth, in Mahanidhana Sutta. Because of our desire, we search, research, look for something. When we search and research, we find something. Then we decide what to keep, what to give away. What you have kept, you got to protect it. When you try to protect it, you have to safeguard it. To safeguard it, you have to have lockers and, safety deposit box and fences and walls and weapons and guns and bombs and so forth to protect what you have. And then you start fighting, verbal fighting, physical fighting, using weapons and so forth. Why? Because you are attached to what you have. Here Buddha said, you fight the Mara with weapon of wisdom, wisdom weapon, fight the Mara, to overcome all these mental states, defilements, and then you gain what you gain, you protect it without attachment. When you fight with Mara, what do you gain? What is Mara? Mara is kamate patamasena. Mara has its army. Greed is one battalion of Mara. You fight greed. Using your wisdom, you fight. When you fight the greed, what you gain is the thought of generosity. When you gain the thought of generosity, don't become attached to the thought of generosity. And protect your thought of generosity without attachment to generosity. Even if you become attached, to generosity, you have not won the war with the Mara. Because you are attached to generosity. Attachment, you are fighting attachment, and once you gain generosity, and if you try to attach to the generosity, you have not won the war. You have not won anything. So Buddha said, this is a very tricky thing. You want to practice, for example, metta, loving friendliness. You want to practice. You have to fight against the hatred. And you fight the hatred and become friendly, gain friendship, gain metta. If you become attached to metta and you hate to lose metta, you have not won. You have lost. See the wisdom, the way how the wisdom operates. We have to be very, very sharp, clear, in our understanding of wisdom, to use it to live wisely. So Buddha said, jitañca rakke aniveshano siya, protect what you gain without becoming attached to what you gain. But that is a very tricky thing. You cannot protect anything if you are not attached to it. So, example of wisdom, there are countless things like this we can quote from the Buddha's teachings to indicate the Buddhist wisdom. What Buddhist wisdom is? It's not very simple thing. One has to be very wise. That is why the Buddha said, this Dhamma is for the wise, not for the unwise. Panyavantasya dhammo nayan dhammo dupanyasa. There are eight great noble or great persons' thoughts, eight thoughts of noble person. The seventh of them is the thought that this Dhamma is for the wise, not for the unwise. And that is why the Buddha said this Dhamma should be realized by the wise individual. Pachattam veditabho vinyuhi. This Dhamma is to be realized by wise individuals. The wiser you are, the deeper your understanding of Dhamma. And that is why wiser people these days are becoming Buddhist all over the world. More people become intelligent. I don't compare intelligent with wisdom. Wisdom is one thing, intelligence is another. But those who are intelligent can gain, if they work hard using their intelligence, then they can gain some wisdom, which leads them to understand the teachings of the Buddha, subtle, profound wisdom of the Buddha's teaching. With this note of wisdom, I like to stop the talk, as Venerable Dhammaratana suggested. We should have some time to answer questions. So, I stop here. Please don't hesitate. We have very few minutes to ask questions, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Wisdom, when we, any moment we minimize our ignorance, wisdom arises. When we eliminate ignorance completely, wisdom becomes fully blossomed. So, so long as ignorance is there, wisdom is concealed, hidden. And therefore, there is no any particular time limit or beginning of wisdom. It's just like ignorance. The moment ignorance, whenever, wherever ignorance is weakened or eliminated, that moment, that place, that individual will have wisdom. So these are two, as I mentioned earlier in the Buddha's teaching, in, according to dependent origination, wisdom depends on ignorance, and ignorance depends on wisdom. The moment wisdom disappears, ignorance arises. The moment ignorance disappears, wisdom arises. The moment wisdom disappears, ignorance arises. But if the ignorance is totally wiped out, wisdom arises never to lose it again. And that is the state which we call the attainment of enlightenment.
If one can capture the pleasant and unpleasant feelings upon contact, and no thoughts is being created subsequently, there's no wholesome and unwholesome deed created, would there be any karma? Is there any karma if you capture the pleasant and unpleasant feelings upon contact, uh-huh, and don't respond to it, to have subsequent thoughts be created?
Now, catching pleasant and unpleasant feeling at the very beginning helps the person to neutralize the feeling. But that doesn't stop committing karma, because feeling itself is not the sole cause of karma. When we have a feeling, pleasant or unpleasant, greed or especially craving can arise. But if we stop, if we caught the feeling at the very beginning, the mind remains, mind becomes neutral. But then we have to do something to follow up using our wisdom. So karma will not stop by realizing or catching the feeling at the beginning. We have to do something more than that. But that is an important point, to catch the feeling at the very beginning, to realize what this feeling is going to do. When the pleasant feeling arises, at the moment of arising of the pleasant feeling, if we do not let the mind become attached to the pleasant feeling, the attachment also will stop at that moment. So it will help the person to develop insight and to commit wholesome karma through insight. Yeah.
Generally, we know arhants or enlightened beings do not perform fresh karma, but they do actions. That's what we learn.
Mm-hmm.
So, Venerable Sir, can say something about that?
Yes, actually that's very true. Arhants also experience pleasant and unpleasant sensations. But since their ignorance is totally wiped out, the pleasantness and unpleasantness of their feelings will not influence their mind to create karma. Karma is definitely created by ignorance. Since an arahant has eliminated ignorance completely, whatever he or she, after attaining arahanthood, does simply become an action without effect. It is just like barren fruit, which is cannot be fertilized, infertile fruit. The fertility of the fruit in this analogy of karma is what is called ignorance. Ignorance fertile karma. So when ignorance is completely eliminated, an arahant, whatever arahant does, will not become a karma. It is the karma, that is why Buddha said, avijjapachya sankhara. Depending on ignorance, sankhara arises, commits. Sankhara means wholesome, unwholesome, imperturbable karma. So when the very root of karma is totally eliminated, then karma will not take place. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned just now that one should not attachment to individual things. But would this non-attachment evolve into indifference?
Non-attachment evolve?
Into indifference.
Indifference?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you don't have attachment, would you become indifferent?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Actually, indifference is a negative mental state. Non-attachment is something totally positive. Non-attachment. Meaning, the mind remains very equanimous, even-mindedness. Equanimity is a very positive, wholesome, highest altruistic mental emotion. They are among emotions pleasantness, unpleasantness, and equanimity. Or in four Brahma Viharas, highest is equanimity. Brahma Viharas are very positive mental states. Highest positive mental emotional state is called equanimity. That is the state that the Buddhas, Arahants maintain all the time. And that is the state you gain when you attain jhanas, highest jhanas state, equanimity. Equanimity is not a neutral, negative position, state of mind. It is balanced state of mind. When the mind is balanced, mind can remain unaffected by negative things. And therefore, when we are not attached to something, we, on the one hand, we can appreciate it. We can appreciate anything when we don't have attachment. If we have attachment, we appreciate certain things and not other things. Because the attachment always is a biased state of mind. When we don't have attachment, we can appreciate anything in the world. So it will not be something negative. Not indifference. Indifference is totally the opposite of equanimity. Yeah.
The Pali term upekkha,
right,
is translated as indifference by some people.
No, that
that's
is
why this problem comes.
Right. This is why we have to learn Pali. When we learn Pali, we can get the correct meaning from Pali language. When you translate it into any other language, we lose the essence, the spirit of the original word. As he mentioned, if you translate upekkha as indifference, then that gives a totally different meaning. Yes. Upekkha, upa ikka, upa means equal, balanced. Ikkati means seeing. You are like, your mind is like a scale. Now in the scale, there's a needle, not the bathroom scales that we use these days. The scale that has two buckets, two plates, in the center there's a needle. So when the needle is right in the center, both sides of the scale are at equal level. That kind of mental state is called equanimity. You are not biased. You make a real justice to the experiences. Yeah. There was, yeah. Right, when you have equanimity, you experience pleasantness, experience unpleasantness, but you will not react to the pleasantness more favorably and unpleasantness less favorably. You don't favor one experience over the other when you have equanimity. Yes. Yes.
Maybe last question, huh?
How to practice letting go without letting go? Actually, letting go is a very lofty idea which you cannot practice 100% at the very beginning. You got to learn to let go of things slowly and gradually, little by little at a time. Now, if you try to let go of everything all of a sudden, you break your neck and you create a lot of problems. You know, even Siddhartha Gautama, when you read the life of the Buddha, you can see that he practiced letting go of things for eons and eons and eons by giving up little bit at a time. For example, you can start letting go of your attachment to junk food. First, let go of your attachment to junk food. That's not difficult. But if you have become obsessively attached to junk food, it will become difficult. So you got to make a determination to stop that and think of your health, positive side, and then decide to eat moderately good food. And then you can let go of the junk, desire for junk. Likewise, we train our mind to let go of marginal things, you see, and then train the mind to let go of other things. Now, even the Buddha did not ask people to cut off everything very quickly. If you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, anybody can live a household life, right livelihood. You can have a good livelihood. Brahmacharya is not mandatory in the Noble Eightfold Path. Brahmacharya, living celibate life, is not recommended to lay people. Lay people can have their wives and husbands, children and so forth, living as a layman and still practice the Dhamma. What he asked us to give up is the obsessive clinging, obsessive attachment. That would become a sickness. Even sex becomes an obsessive attachment. The Buddha did not completely, did not ask people to give that up, but they must learn how to live a household life in moderation. So this is how we train the mind to discipline, to eventually give up. Don't try to give up everything all of a sudden.
I think we can end, but before that I would like to ask something related to your question. I think there are two important words in Buddhist, words in Pali language we have taken from Buddhist teaching. Pema and Metta. So Buddhists can have Metta, but can avoid, I think, pema. But the Buddha said, pema to jayati soko.
Right.
Pema or attachment can bring soka or sorrow.
Right.
Then, but never said metta jayati soko.
Right.
Metta can bring, metta also a kind of love, I think.
Right.
But it is a greater love.
Yes.
But I feel Buddha has taught us to have a greater love than lower level of love with attachment.
Right.
So if Venerable can say something about that,
Now I say the same thing in, there are two words. I use the word desire, wholesome desire and unwholesome desire. Unwholesome desire is desire to perpetuate desire, to increase desire. Wholesome desire is desire to be desireless. So, metta is a wholesome desire. And the nearest enemy of metta is greed, attachment, clinging. Why it is called nearest enemy? Because greed disguises as metta, as loving friendliness, and gets so close to your heart. That is why sometimes people say, I practice metta to my girlfriend. Practice metta to my boyfriend. That is not metta. But attachment to that closest friend appears to the person as loving friendliness. So these two are diametrically opposite mental states, but appear to be the same. And therefore the Buddha said the nearest enemy of metta is greed. The farthest enemy of metta is hatred. Because farther enemy when approaches you can see. Similarly when anger arises you can see and you know it is painful. So, the wholesome side of it is metta, that is very altruistic. You don't say, I practice metta to you on these conditions. You don't say that. I practice metta to the whole world if the world treats me in this way. We don't say that. Without any condition, I practice metta to all living beings. And that is why metta is more altruistic, higher, greater than desire, ordinary desire. As he said, prema, filial love, love for children, love for parents, parents love for parents, parents love for children, children's love for parents. It's a good love. But there is some clinging, craving, attachment to each other, which is not equivalent to metta practice. But parents can have metta towards children, children can have metta towards parents without any condition. Children can say, Daddy, Mommy, it doesn't matter what you say to me, I have tremendous metta towards you. Parents can say to children the same thing. So, that is what we call unconditional love. So we can close this session this morning. I am very pleased that you all came and asked me very intelligent, meaningful questions. Please keep up with your practice and try to come up with more questions next time. And we have to close it. Thank you very much for your patient listening.